and Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. 92 people are still listed as missing in Western North Carolina 3 weeks after Hurricane Helene. Governor Roy Cooper.
The task force, law enforcement, and other partners will continue working to locate those who are unaccounted for.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken warn in a letter to Israel that the U.S. could review arms shipments to Israel if it does not improve humanitarian conditions in Gaza. National Security Spokesman John Kirby.
This particular letter that we're talking about now follows a relatively recent decrease in humanitarian assistance reaching the people of Gaza.
Cases of whooping cough are on the rise in the U.S. Dr. William Schaffner with Vanderbilt University.
Vaccination is key. Infant vaccination, childhood, adolescent, and then all of we adults should be getting our every 10-year vaccination against tetanus, diphtheria, and whooping cough.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Join us live every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. for Playmakers, brought to you by Quality Plus Printing. Call in with your sports thoughts and feelings only on WFHR.
Civic Media News, I'm Derek Tritz. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Ballots can't be processed before Election Day in Wisconsin. Voter advocates say that this could make Wisconsin vulnerable to lies and conspiracy theories about the results.
Due to that policy or lack thereof in Wisconsin, I think we'll potentially see some delays in the counting of mail ballots and therefore delays in unofficial results in the state this year.
Brian Hinkle is with the Movement Advancement Project. A bill to legalize early ballot processing died for lack of action in the state Senate this year. Thousands of chickens in western Wisconsin have been left homeless after the company Pure Prairie Poultry abandoned its Wisconsin farms. There are still 30,000 chickens who used to belong to the company's flocks being given away by volunteers with Pips and Chicks. Local farms giving away chickens can be found on the Pips and Chicks Facebook page. And that's what you need to know. I'm Derek Tritz, and this is Civic Media News.
The Morning Show on WFHR. It's serious comedy.
The top-selling Halloween candies in every state over the past 17 years.
Nicely done, Melissa. I'm not sure.
What, were you clearing your throat? What was that?
It was a macabre kind of.
It really was.
Why the 17 years? That seems a little.
That's arbitrary.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Candystore.com.
When they started making Halloween candy, guys.
Oh yeah, 17 years ago.
Weekdays from 8 to 10.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Had an interesting conversation at the hospital today that got me thinking the misinformation machine is gotten out of hand. I literally had someone who told me that Donald Trump not only won in 2020, but actually won the popular vote by millions. Said he didn't believe anything of the vote whatsoever. And you go, most sane, rational people would go, yeah, you lost the popular vote without question, because math, understanding how the country is divided up, where people live, the sizable wins that are, you know, are run up in places like California or New York, which are strong Democratic strongholds, and you go, you know, because of those places, run up the vote tally, wasn't even making the argument that he won the electoral vote. No, won the popular vote. And it was one of these moments where I said, you know, dude, lots of misinformation. So I started going through some of the right-wing misinformation machines, you know, hit list. You know, like the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. He bought hook, line, and sinker. John Kerry was a coward. His medals didn't mean anything. He went through the birther movement. You know, Barack Obama, you know, wasn't born in the U.S. There was no evidence. Bought into all of the Planned Parenthood videos that we now know were heavily edited and doctored. bought all of it, all the widespread voter fraud in 2016, that Ukraine, not Russia, it was Ukraine that interfered in the 2016 election, and then regaled me of stories about Benghazi and how Hillary Clinton ordered the deaths of those four folks, and just on and on. How the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 created millions of jobs, cut the federal deficit. All of this, wow. You go, where are you getting this stuff from? And you go, well, right-wing talk radio, of cable news. You know, they just make stuff up. And the weird thing is we've got a guy running for vice president who's saying, I'm just making stuff up because I want you to pay attention. So we're going to lie to you. Because this is what they do. It's what they've always done. But the weird part, and this is the part that's interesting to me. They're no longer trying to insulate themselves by having third parties. You've got candidates coming out with some of the biggest kookery. And, you know, when I went through some of these moments, this guy did not flinch. All on board. So it's not even a matter of drinking the tea. It's being doused in the tea. So the question is with this kind of massive misinformation machine, where so many people know so much of what isn't true or reality, how do you then govern a nation? As I spoke to this guy just for fun, not attempting to convince him of anything one way or the other, I simply said, you know, the reality is, you know, you're beyond a discussion. You're set in your ways. There's no questioning that, discussing that. You are where you are. I'm leaving you to be that way. And look, as citizens, you have to let the fives go. You have to let the extremists go and focus on people who are somewhat attached to the real world. Because sadly, too many people are living in this alternative reality of the economy's terrible. Cities are literally burning to the ground. MS-13s around every corner. Gangs are taking over. And you've got presidential candidates who are all in. You've got Donald Trump, who is all in. And why? Well, quite frankly, because he knows it's the only way he can win. Because he's not bringing anything to the table. He's not talking about how he's going to make lives better. He's not talking about policy. I know he's got a concept of a plan, but no real plans. It seems like an easy election to get through. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. We'll bunch after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, you know, J.D. Vance and this idea of just making stuff up. Just, you know, reaching around to the backside, pulling something out of the dark side of the moon, something out of the rear orifice, if you will. And truth be damned, reality be damned, honesty, integrity, never mind. We've got an agenda, evidently. And the weird thing is And this is what I've been saying for years. What Trump's, the mastery of Trump, you know, is basically, you know, Orwell's 1984, the 2 minutes hate, only it's, well, 2 minutes of hate, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year for the last, what are we, 9 years into this nightmare? I'm here to share some thoughts on the simple question. Do we want to live in reality, or do we want to live in this dangerous hellscape dream world that the conservative and the right have created in their minds? That's why I've asked Will Bunch to come talk with us. Will is a national columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. You can check out his work over at the Philly Inquirer. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me back.
So, you know, I've been using this frame for a while because, you know, 1984, evidently another banned book, part of the banning of my high school reading list. I still remember that kind of, that 2 minutes hate where you're screaming at something, you don't even know why, you're just angry. And the idea was just to keep people on edge. We're living that in real time and have been for, well, quite some time.
Yeah, you know, I think what's kind of interesting is you're right. It's just both the length of time and the amount of vitriol have just constantly expanded, right? Because I felt like when Trump was running, when he started running 2015 and into 2016, you did have something that was like the 2 minutes hate. And it was, I guess it was especially noticeable to me because it was directed at the media, right? There'd be a point in the middle of his rally where, you know, he'd say, and look at these people, they're the enemies of the people, turn around. And everybody in the arena would turn around or turn to the side at this little caged in area where, you know, maybe 50 journalists were trying to work, and just boo and, you know, make gestures. And it was 2 minutes. But, you know, in this campaign, here we are 8 years later, and it feels like it's 80, 90 minutes of nonstop hate. And, yeah.
But let me ask you this before you go on. I mean, you know, because we have talked about that in the past, and it's always been weird to me that you go, if you're a journalist, why do you subject yourself to this? Wouldn't it be great if nobody showed up going, you know, look, if you're going to use us as your whipping boy, we're just not going to participate. You can talk to yourself. If you're going to make us evil and the enemy, we're not going to play along.
Yeah, I mean, especially in this day and age, there's always some way to watch Trump's rallies remotely anyway, without just having to physically be in this pit. The only people who really physically need to be there are camera people, you know, the people operating the cameras. So you're talking about a dozen people. I mean, I go to Trump rallies to talk to the voters such as they are, you know, and not to hear what Trump has to say. But I do feel this escalation that you're talking about. You know, after 8 years of this, it's like, the stories have to get bigger. The lies have to get bigger, you know. And, you know, we've talked before about how this whole immigration thing has been 20, 25 years in the making, right? You know, going back to the 2000s and the Rush Limbaugh era, and, you know, warning people about the dangers of these people coming into our country. And I think honestly what's happened to a great extent is, you know, I mean, we've had these influxes of people coming into this country in a lot of cities. And you know, and I know with the union orientation of the show, it can be complicated in some industries and some areas. But in a lot of these cities, they're clearly helping the economy. You know, they're clearly, for whatever reason, filling a need both for workers, and in doing so, they're filling a need for, you know, they're filling vacant homes, shopping in the supermarkets.
To that point, I just had a conversation with a friend today and said, look, you know, a lot of our inflation issues, corporate greed being right at the top of it. But part of it is we haven't had that steady flow of younger immigrant labor willing to work crummy jobs. And I pointed to restaurants. You know, you go to the back of the house of most restaurants now, they're trying to fill with people who aren't going to work for poverty, desperation wages like they were able to before the pandemic, because you had a steady flow of immigrant labor coming in. And you could go, you know, blame Trump for that. This is what we're not talking about as well. And I, to your point, I agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've had, and also, you know, we've had study after study proving what seems to be transface, which is these immigrant populations, you know, these groups that come here have lower crime rates than native born Americans, because they're coming here to, you know, they're coming here to work. They're not coming here to commit crimes. And it's obvious. And so we're at that point where he needs to scare voters more, and he's got less to work with. Yeah. So he's making stuff up there. You know, you mentioned J.D. Vance at the start of this segment. And, you know, what did he say? That we have to be out there creating stories, quote unquote, to get people to pay attention to
you. Mean lying?
Yeah.
We used to call that lying.
He wants America to pay attention to something that's not happening, because doing so helps the Trump campaign and helps the J.D. Vance campaign.
Now, what's interesting, I got to be honest, what's interesting is at least in 2015, 2016, there was this facade of, you know, we care about you, that we're going to reshore manufacturing, we're going to rebuild infrastructure, we're going to do all the things that I wanted him to do. Had he done, he would have been unbeatable in 2020. But again, it was never about that. It was about all of this other stuff. And now they've given up on the idea that they're going to do anything for us. It's what they're going to do to us.
Yeah, I mean, look at a place like Springfield, Ohio. I mean, I've been to Springfield. We used to stop there at the local Holiday Inn on our way out there. I think you and I may have talked about this before, but that city had fallen on really hard times, and it's been revitalized. And it's not, you know, it's downtown's revitalized, and you know, yeah, housing prices are up, but that's what happens when you attract new workers and new industry. You know,
it's called capitalism. Will,
yeah, it's if like Ford came in and said, hey, we're opening up a new, you know, electric vehicle or whatever plant, we're going to employ 10,000 people, and people from Appalachia and West Virginia or whatever moved into Ohio to take these jobs, even if they were native born people, you know what would happen? The rents would go up, because that's you know,
it's capitalism. Will,
I took economics for poets in college, Econ 1. It was economics for non-economics major, and the way that rent and housing prices works was the first week of the class, and you know, it's pretty basic. You know, it's like you want your city to be growing, you want jobs. Well, one of the side effects of that is it's going to be more expensive to rent an apartment. You know.
You're spot on right. And look, and this is where I keep saying that, you know, inflation isn't high enough, evidently, because we keep buying stuff. If inflation were too high, we would stop.
Right. And then there'd be a recession. And there's been no recession. So you couldn't be more right. So, And so my most recent column, you know, they've gone from exaggerating problems to just making problems up. I mean, they've really created a fantasy world, you know, where, you know, I mean, it's like I guess it was late last week, they came out with the new inflation numbers, and inflation was the lowest it's been since the pandemic, you know, it's down to 2.3%. You know, Trump goes out at a rally that night and says, you know, look at these new numbers, the worst inflation we've ever seen. You know, it's just so blatant. It's not, I mean, at least it used to be the lies were based on something.
On a kernel of reality, right? It's like when J.D. Vance held a press conference talking about eggs being like $8 a dozen, and he's standing in front of the eggs that are saying $2.99 a dozen.
Yeah, or you know, they're saying gasoline is $8 a gallon, I mean, I have not watched a Republican, you know, a Trump rally or any Republican event this year where there hasn't been a big to-do about how crime is out of control and going up. And yet, I mean, the numbers are like crashing through the floor, you know? I mean,
or Chicago is a burning hellscape. You know, we walked around Chicago during the convention. I asked the Uber driver, take me to where it's burning, please.
Yeah, it's not happening. You know, I think the city of Boston has had 10 homicides for the entire year so far. And I mean, Philadelphia, you know, it's like, well, what about Philadelphia, you guys? And we did have a couple really bad years for crime here in Philly. There's no doubt about it. But last month we had 10 homicides for the month, which, you know, we're like a large city. So, that was the lowest monthly homicide total again in like since the pandemic.
Yeah. But, you know, here's the thing, and this is to pick up on this, is, you know, you keep having that message reinforced. And, you know, and again, this is one of those things that, you know, I was just talking to somebody about, you know, when the right talks about Philly, they talk about Cleveland, they talk about Detroit, you know, any of these cities, it's not, you know, to highlight what a wonderful city is. It's to highlight the fact that their population is heavily black. So it's really the race, you know, that dog whistle race issue that they keep throwing out. I mean, Trump, what did Trump say the other day about Detroit? You know, if Harris is elected president, you know, the whole country is going to look like Detroit. And that's meant to scare rural America.
It kind of backfires, though. I mean, like look at Wisconsin. I mean, before the convention in Milwaukee, it came out that like Trump hated Milwaukee, that he hated it so much that he'd originally planned to stay in Chicago and limo up there every night until he got found out and they told him, no, you absolutely can't do that. But you know, and his poll numbers after that convention, and his Wisconsin poll numbers after that convention in Milwaukee, which the whole point of which is to, you know, make people in Wisconsin love the Republican Party, their poll numbers went down because they could tell Trump didn't want to be there, you know, and right. And then he goes to Detroit and insults Detroit. And, you know, people do associate with their metro areas. Here in Philadelphia, people who live in the suburbs gripe about what goes on in the city a lot. But there's a lot of regional, you know, our sports teams and all that other stuff. But there's a lot of regional pride that, like, when you start tearing these places down, it doesn't go over that well.
Yeah, look, I grew up in Cleveland. I defend the city. It's got problems, like every city, but I'll defend it. You call my city a mistake on the lake, and we're going to have problems. But, you know, this is where, you know, but this alternative reality that they keep throwing out there is dangerous. And I look at these stories, you know, coming out of, you know, out of North Carolina, out of Florida, where there are stories of militias now hunting FEMA because they've been told that FEMA is going to come take their, you know, I don't know what, come take their cameras or their dogs or I don't know what. But they've been told that, hey, FEMA's coming for you. So now we've got this potential of danger to the point where, as I understand it, you know, FEMA moved out of an area for their own safety.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, and I mean, these rumors about the hurricane and about, you know, FEMA was blocking flights, you know, blocking relief flights and, you know, preventing people from giving help. And, it, you know, things that just made absolutely no sense. But then, of course, when you've got so many people believing the government is controlling the weather or somehow caused these hurricanes or the government could stop these hurricanes, but they didn't want to do it because they were red states or, you know, I mean, you know, and what's scary is this is flowing right into the election, right? Yep. So, if people are going to get in their Taliban style trucks and intimidate FEMA workers, you know, what are they going to do to election workers on November 5th?
And look, in December 11th, I mean, you know, the reality is there are some important dates coming up where, you know, I know the right is organizing for chaos. I know they're going to go after governors to not certify electors. I know that you think January 6th was fun. Just wait till they bring it to the state level. There's a lot of problems coming up.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was thinking the same thing. I was actually on a call about some people who've been doing these war game type exercises about possible post-election violence. You know, we kind of forget December 11th, you know, because all we remember from last time around is January 6th. But these guys could do a lot more harm in Lansing or Harrisburg than they could in D.C., you know. I mean, these are state capitals that are surrounded by rural Trump country areas, you know, or Madison, for that matter, you know, all these state capitals in these swing states are vulnerable. I mean, we saw some crazy, if you remember the, some of the crazy stuff that happened in state capitals during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
What I'm looking at is Atlanta. I mean, Atlanta, to me, with all of the laws, what is it, SB 202 that they passed a while ago, it's a felony to give pizza to somebody in line or a bottle of water to somebody in line who's going to vote. They're throwing people, they're challenging people's votes at obscene numbers. I mean, it's just all kind of craziness. And then also, you got someone like Brian Kemp who, and I guess they've kissed and made up him and Trump. So who knows where this goes? But again, I think a lot of us still believe can't happen here.
Yeah, and that was something else I addressed in the column. I mean, certainly the biggest mainstream news organizations, the ones that are so influential, the New York Times obviously gets talked about the most, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and the big TV networks, the big cable networks, there's definitely a lack of imagination. One of the things I found most stunning was the top editor at the New York Times, Joe Kahn, gave an interview when he said, we understand that our freedom as journalists here in this country is fragile, and that we've seen what happened in Hungary and other places, and we know that can happen here. And it's like, all right, if you're seeing that and you're having this conversation, so why is this not reflected in your news coverage? You should be alarmed at a lot of things Trump's saying, but I mean, Trump's even threatening your own profession and you're not saying anything. I mean,
no, and the fact that the right is so emboldened with this Project 2025 that they wrote all of their bad ideas down in one place. I mean, to me, that's arrogance on a level that I don't think we've seen in this country before.
Yeah, and I think that arrogance is being reflected right now in Trump's campaign and his rallies. He constantly does the opposite of what the conventional wisdom is, right? And so the conventional wisdom would be, well, he's getting closer to the election, maybe he's going to tone things down, maybe he'll even,
That's not what Roy Cohn taught him to do.
Yeah, I just saw that movie last night. That is not what Roy Cohn taught him to do. Roy Cohn's first rule was attack, attack, attack. And, Trump has seen his poll numbers bounce back a little bit in the last couple of weeks. And that just emboldens them more. It's like, It's like, see, I'm on the right track,
No, and this is where, last line of questioning I got for you, because this is where this remigration idea has me kind of worried, because, there are a lot of people I know who secretly go, the country's changing. And they wouldn't mind a big bus to see a lot of their neighbors rounded up and moved back wherever they came from.
Yeah, but the problem is it's not going to stop. I think it's a big problem to do it for undocumented immigrants. But the other problem is that it's not going to stop at undocumented immigrants. It's interesting because this Operation Aurora now that he's talking about, which is named after a gang problem in a Colorado city that actually doesn't have a gang problem like the one he's talking about. So it's an operation based on another Trump lie. But anyway, I'm sure you saw that he believes, he and his aides like Stephen Miller believe the legal foundation for this operation is a 17, anything with a 17 in front of it, it's like, well, of course, the Constitution, I guess, right?
Well, that's the original intent people's argument. We should go back to the original intent. And those are the people who have been studying this stuff. So, of course, they're going to pull that out of their,
Yeah, right. Exactly. So this 1798 Alien Enemies Act. And it's like, the problem is it's been used since 1798. It was used in 1942 to round up Japanese Americans and put them in internment camps. And one of the things that I've always found stunning about the Japanese internment is it wasn't just people who were not U.S. citizens. I mean, people who were U.S. citizens of Japanese descent were rounded up and put in camps. And, basically this law, it sounds like, has so much leeway that, all right, it starts with undocumented immigrants. Then the Haitian American
green cards
people
and people with temporary status all down the line until eventually, you know, again, they came for the undocumented and I said nothing. And by the time they got down to me, there was nobody else.
Yeah. I mean, once when they cross that line from undocumented immigrants into legal immigrants and start, quote, remigrating, unquote, them, you know, then it's just going to spread to, you know, rhinos and journalists and radio
talk
hosts
show hosts.
And, yeah. I was going to say, yeah. So, you know, it's just not going to stop, which is, you know, what's happened in other countries, like it happened again, in Germany in the 1930s.
Why elections are so important. And I hope everyone gets registered, has a plan to vote, gets out to vote, because this is all going to be about turnout. We're not making new voters on either side. It's just about getting sane, rational people to the polls. But Will, as always, great work there at the Philly Inquirer. Appreciate the time.
All right. Thanks so much, Rick. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, our good friend Will Bunch. Make sure you check out their work over at Inquirer.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at Will's stuff. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear areas of frost tonight, low upper 20s. Sunshine returns tomorrow, a little warmer, high in the upper 50s. For Thursday and Friday, sunshine continues along with the warming trend. Breezy, high mid-60s Thursday, upper 60s Friday. Currently it's 37.
The excitement.
Oh, he stones Bronczynski with a glove save.
The energy.
What's he going to do? He shoots and he scores.
The tradition.
You've got to understand history if you're ever going to write your own.
It's everything.
He scores. Badgers answer right back.
This is your radio home for Wisconsin Badger hockey.
Sponsored by Johnson & Sons Chrysler Jeep, Econ Electric, and 8th Street Auto. Listen on 97.5 FM, 1320 AM, WFHR, streaming live and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, I'm really, really angry at myself. And look, I'm going through some stuff right now, some family stuff. So I'm cutting myself a break on this, but last week, my good friend Scott Paul and his organization, the Alliance for American Manufacturing, were in the neighborhood. They were down in Reading, about an hour from here, held a showing of their film that I think everyone should see, the relighting film. And you know, as I've been saying, you know, we need these kind of documents, these kind of films that share reality, not the stuff that we're being force fed from the corporate controlled media, but real life stories of individuals. I saw a little angry at myself for missing it. But as I said, I'm going to give myself a pass. But here to share some thoughts on the relighting film, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts, maybe get some feedback from the audience that were there in Reading, Pennsylvania. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you. And you know what? You're always with us there in spirit, man. So
I appreciate it.
So no sweat off the brow there.
Yeah. I have seen the film.
Yeah.
Great piece. We've talked about it before. This is, you know, one of the times you've gone out, you know, to the greater audience, had people come in. What was it like?
So I loved it because, well, first of all, I love that Reading has a film festival. I never knew that. And it's actually a really good one. And so we were part of a block of what they called inspirational documentaries. And I was like, first of all, to have a movie set inside a steel mill, basically, that's inspirational, there's a change, right? Because you never saw that before with any kind of documentary or fictional portrayal of a steel mill. It just never happened, right? So that was cool. And there was a really full house, which was nice. And I really enjoyed showing it in Reading because, Rick, as you know, I mean, that's a town that has been really, really beset by deindustrialization. I mean, you know, auto parts, Dana, you know, steel. Oh my God, we could go
on and on.
Yeah, but that's one of the most deindustrialized communities in Pennsylvania and the United States. And so it was interesting to get the audience reaction to it, which was, I mean, there's a part when one of the women who's featured in the documentary, you know, her dad talks about what a starting salary in a steel mill is today, which is like $80,000 to $90,000 plus benefits and overtime. And there were audible gasps from the audience, like they didn't believe it, right? And then the fact that they were hiring and the feedback that we got was like, this was so great, or I've never seen how steel was made, and it's nice to see this. And so I think that, I mean, this was a film going audience that was there to see a lot of other documentaries too, but it was really, really great to show it in a town which has really felt, you know, kind of factory closures and all of that, to see the response when you showed them what it could be. Yeah. Like, no, clearly, with the right policies.
Yeah. Clearly, Reading was a place that used to be. I mean, it used to be heavy into manufacturing. It used to be heavy into textiles. This was 50, 60 years ago, this was a booming economic place. And deindustrialization, bad trade deals, you know, monopolization, you know, trade with, you know, globally, that's you know, not competitive. We've given away that manufacturing base, and Reading is one of those places. What was a couple of years ago? It was the poorest community in the country a couple years ago. So this is a place where this film should be seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, and it's one of those areas in Pennsylvania that's very much contested in the election, right? And so it was nice to see that. And you just reminded me that all those textile mills are an outlet mall, right? You know, which is like, I guess I don't want to call that the natural progression of the economy, because it's like in reverse. But yeah, so there was a whole lot of reasons why it was great to show that film there and to see the audience response. And we've screened it in Cleveland, we've screened it in DC. It was at the Grand Rapids, Michigan Film Festival. We screened it in Northwest Indiana, which has got the largest steelmaking communities in the country. And it's going to be in New York City as part of the Workers Unite Film Festival, which is the biggest kind of labor film festival in the country, on October 24th. So it's been really, really an honor and a pleasure to be able to
share this great
documentary with folks.
Very cool. And look, if you can't make it to New York, you can still see it online, right? I mean, it's out on YouTube to see for free, Relighting the Flame, the film, right?
That's exactly right. You can just go to, if you go to our YouTube channel at AmericanManufacturing.org, it pops right up there, or just, you know, Google in Relighting the Flame, and it'll get to you. And we welcome, we welcome folks to take a look at it. You'll be happy for the 25 minutes that you spent. Looking inside these lives that have been transformed by a job in a reborn steel industry in the United States.
Now, let's also talk about steel. I see that U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai on Friday was in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, at the Cleveland Cliffs mill there, talking about how bad trade policy has really put us in this mix. Any thoughts on her visit?
Yeah, it was, first of all, it was great to be there with the trade ambassador, and also with acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu was there. Lorenzo Gonzalez, who's the CEO of Cleveland Cliffs, was there. A lot of steel workers who I know, you know, Rick, were there as well. And to hear from the workers, and this was interesting because this particular mill in Coatesville, first of all, it's been there since 1825. So it's almost 200 years old. It's 199 years old. And it started out as an iron forge. And it's been making military products basically since the Civil War, right? And so that's what it still does today. It does this really thick armor plate that goes into our submarines, that goes into our aircraft carriers, but also structural, plate that goes into a lot of the great bridges that we know, like that rebuilt Tappan Zee Bridge in New York, which is now called the Cuomo Bridge, or the steel that was in, you know, some of the trestles from the World Trade Center. And in fact, a couple of them, you know, survived, and they have one of them at that mill, which is just fascinating. So the history behind this is extraordinary. And we got a chance to talk about shipbuilding. And I thought that was kind of exciting because there is this potential to kind of scale up commercial shipbuilding in the United States with this trade case, the steelworkers, the boilermakers, the machinists, IBW, the maritime trades filed with the U.S. Trade representative. And so, you know, they'll make a decision about what's going to happen with that within the next, I think, the next 4 or 5 months now. And but we have the potential to kind of get some of this back because the disparity between what we're able to do and what China does is just extraordinary now.
Yeah, I read
and like Coatesville. Yeah, sorry,
no,
Rick.
No, ahead. I was reading a Wall Street Journal article that brought this up, and they were saying that, you know, because China has invested so much in shipbuilding over the past 2 decades, that they now can build more ships in a month than we can build in a year.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, we have, first of all, we have 4 naval shipyards that build for our military, okay? And one of those, like, builds submarines, one of those builds aircraft carriers, and then a couple of the others build the other kind of naval vessels that we do. And then we have some commercial shipyards, but it's a fraction of what we used to have. And we make sometimes, you know, as few as 5 or 10 ocean-going vessels a year, 5 or 10. And China's making hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these, in fact, oftentimes in the thousands. So, yeah, the disparity is just off the charts about what China's able to put in the water versus what we are. And there are now all these, like, you know, sirens going around Washington because they realize that this is a real problem for commerce, for security, for our military. And so we hope that we can, I guess my pun is intended here, right the ship soon, because, you know, it obviously puts people to work in steel mills like Coatesville, but more importantly, make sure that you, myself, everybody else in this country has some degree of economic and national security as well.
Now, you're talking about all these ships that they're building, and as you said, you know, hundreds, probably even thousands of them. What are they going to do with them? I mean, this is just another example of them, you know, overproducing to the point where they're going to crush everybody else and put everybody else out of business. Or is there a real market for all these ships?
Yeah, no, they overproduce. There is no question about it. And their scale up has come at the expense of other shipbuilding nations, and not only the United States, but also Japan, South Korea, and some of the European shipyards as well. And so we're all feeling this, but it's particularly acute in the United States because our decline in shipbuilding coincided with 2 things. First was when Reagan ended the shipbuilding program that provided some support to these shipyards because they're very capital intensive.
Sure.
If you've ever been to one, you just see, you're like, there is so much stuff around here. How much this had to cost a fortune. And it does. So he ended the shipbuilding program that we had. And at the same time, Korea, Japan were scaling up their programs. And so it was like a double whammy to the U.S. But starting in the 80s, we saw a decline. And then it was just turbocharged once China came on with all of its capacity. And so, yeah, our shipyards are hanging on by a thread, and we got to do better because this is how we build our strength. I mean, this
absolutely
is how we won wars. Yeah. So.
No, but, you know, this is, for me, manufacturing as a whole, which is why we talk about quite often manufacturing being a national security issue. If you don't have the ability to ramp up wartime production, by having available facilities, you're at a disadvantage. And you go back, and I know we've beaten this, pretty well. But you know, World War II, we did well because there were other factories that could be quickly turned into wartime production. Not that I'm calling for a war. Not that I want a war. Not that I think it's a good idea to have a war. But sometimes stuff happens, and you have to be able to produce, or, hey, maybe pandemics pop up. And having the ability to ramp up production sounds like good policy.
Yes. Well, I mean, look, we're seeing this play out in real time in other types of military production. And, you know, I'm just going to bring up Ukraine here. You know, we have very few factories that actually make munitions in the United States, and they're basically working overtime to help keep our ally supplied against Putin's aggression and also keep our own stocks up. And we don't have a lot of redundancy there. And to your point, yes, we hope to God none of this ever happens. But unfortunately, we've seen, if history shows us anything, is you have to be prepared for all of that. And yes, we could convert auto factories and steel mills and other things into shipbuilding and airplane building and what have you. But you know, you can't convert a McDonald's into that. You can't convert a dollar store. You can't convert a Walmart into any of that. You can't convert a data center into that. And so that's why we do need some of this capacity in the United States. So not only to build commercial ships, but to be ready in the event, God forbid, that we need something if we're attacked.
And you can't. Open up the crumbling remains of our past. Because, you know, I go back to my hometown, the Cleveland. You got out on the flats. There are still buildings there that haven't been taken down that were factories in the past. You go to Flint, Michigan, where the auto industry used to be. You go across this country, and there are remnants of a manufacturing powerhouse that sadly are crumbling before our eyes. So the fact that we now have something of the beginnings of an industrial policy for the first time in my lifetime, fairly exciting, because maybe we're going to bring manufacturing back. And with that, as a union guy, maybe the union jobs that built the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity when my grandparents walked the earth.
Yeah, you are spot on there. And so I am hopeful because I think that there's a couple of factors that have contributed to this. One is that everybody now has felt this pain. You know, it was factory workers who lost their jobs and then their families and their communities that felt it. But during the pandemic, everybody felt it, right? When they couldn't get medicine or they couldn't get other things that they desperately needed, or prices went up because everything was stuck on a ship somewhere, okay? So everybody kind of felt this, and so there was this like, okay, we can't do that anymore. And then we've also seen, I think, the proof points that this industrial policy can work. I mean, you have semiconductor factories being built all over the United States of America right now, and it's not because, you know, it's not accidental. It's because we put a policy into place that said we're going to provide some help for private companies to stand up these semiconductor factories, and we're going to do this in other important sectors as well. And so we know that this can work. And the last thing that I will say this is that I think finally the people who support industrial policy also understand that trade and tariffs have to be a part of this too for it to work. Otherwise, you're just putting that money into a sieve and it's going right out to China. Yeah. And so I think that they now understand that you have to have a strong trade policy, as the Biden-Harris administration has had. And Ambassador Tai has done an excellent job of doing this. They have not been negotiating free trade agreements. In fact, quite the opposite. They've negotiated zero free trade agreements, but they've been enforcing. They've been putting more tariffs on products coming from China. At the same time, we've been investing in our critical industries here at home.
And that's, again, for me, this administration has been transformational in just what you pointed out. No more bad trade agreements, actually trying to correct some of the past. Now, I do got to kind of wrap this up and move us in a different direction. I've always said that if you if you really believe in this whole idea of domestic production for domestic consumption, you got to buy stuff. And we got a holiday coming up in, what, 70-some days? It's the big buying time of the year, and you guys are putting together your Made in America holiday gift guide. Walk me through.
Yeah. So everyone listening can be a part of this. Like, if you've ever received a gift or bought a gift that was made in the United States and you want other people to know about it, this is the place to do it. This is the absolute best Made in America holiday gift guide that you're going to find out there. It's been featured in the Wall Street Journal, a bunch of other places as well. And we curate gift ideas that are manufactured or made in every single state in the United States of America. You know, Alaska, Hawaii, you name it, we've got them all, but it takes your help. And so if you see something out there that you want to bring to our attention, this is actually the week to do it, because this is the week we're compiling all of this. The gift guide comes out in about a month, but send them our way. You can find the portal, again, at AmericanManufacturing.org. We would love to have those ideas, and we do get a lot of listener submissions on Made in America gifts. And nice. There's a ton of stuff to buy. And I'm just going to give you one example. I wore my pagoda socks to Reading because of the pagoda there that were designed by a woman who grew up in Reading, Pennsylvania, and has them made at a knitting mill in North Carolina. And it's just, and it's called This Night, the socks are. Nice. And it's awesome. But there's stuff like that all over the country.
Nice. And if you make this stuff, by all means, submit it as well. And are you making because one of the things that I wish Amazon would do on their website is to put things that are made in the U.S. Give me more information on where it was made. If it was union made, I would love to see that, because I would buy, most certainly without question, union made, American made products exclusively if I could. But it's the information and the work you guys do, fabulous. But is there a demarcation for that?
There is. Well, obviously, everything on there is made in the United States. And we also note when it's union made as well. And our steelworker partners and others help us along with that. And so we provide tons of information about that. Unfortunately, unlike a lot of your other online shopping experiences that you might have, but you're going to everything that we have in that guide and our directory is manufactured in the United States. And we have a bunch of stuff that's union made on there as well. And I know the AFL has started an exclusive kind of union made gift guide as well. I don't think it covers all 50 states, but that will be out during the holiday season as well.
I'm looking forward to it. I hope people will make submissions. AmericanManufacturing.org, where you can go to do that. But Scott, as always, great stuff.
Rick, thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate the time. Our good friend, Scott Paul. Question, would you buy American made, union made stuff if you knew? If the Amazons of the world said, hey, here it is, would you look for that? I hope so. Want to hear it? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day that President George H.W. Bush signed the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. Worker safety at the Nevada nuclear test site had been sacrificed during the Cold War era, as the United States rushed to keep pace with the Soviet Union's nuclear arsenal. The result was an increase in cancers, including leukemia, from workers being exposed to deadly radiation. For more than a decade, these workers tried to get Congress to pass legislation for compensation for radiation sickness. Uranium miners from states including Nevada, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Wyoming also joined the effort, filing a suit against the government. The courts ruled against the workers, ruling that national security needs trumped the safety of workers. Democratic Representative Wayne Owens from Utah sponsored a bill to give the workers compensation. In a statement carried by the New York Times, Representative Owens called the bill, quote, an apology to those people and their heirs on behalf of the government and the American people that were subjected and sacrificed for the Cold War nuclear weapons. President Bush explained the scope of the act at the signing ceremony, saying, quote, "The bill provides compassionate payments to persons with specified diseases who fear that their health was harmed because of the fallout from atmospheric atomic testing at the Nevada test site. Regardless of whether causation can be scientifically established, the bill entitles each person meeting specific criteria to a payment of $50,000. Uranium miners meeting separate criteria will be entitled to compassionate payments in the amount of $100,000. The bill established a $100 million fund for the workers and residents who lived downwind of the Nevada test site. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, relighting the flame film .com, I believe it is. Check out AmericanManufacturing.org for the link to the movie, which I think, you know, look, fabulous. Just fabulous. And something we should be talking about, relighting the flame of manufacturing. Of, I remember when I, you know, growing up in Cleveland, you would drive through downtown, you would see off into the distance in the flats, you would see the flame coming out of the steel mill, obviously where this title comes from. And you knew in that plant there were thousands of people who were making, you know, really good wages, benefits, you know, a pension. There were families that were benefiting. There was a community that benefited from it. Now, did it have its problems? Yeah, pollution was terrible in Cleveland in the 70s because of the manufacturing. We have the technology to clean all that up. We can do smart things. We can do you know, manufacturing at home and still be able to breathe clean air. It seems sane, seems rational, seems like something we should want. And surprisingly, you know, you go back through all of these presidencies of my lifetime where people were saying, you know, how much they love America and how much they wave the flag. And yet they come up with trade deals and gimmicks and allow the Chamber of Commerce and corporate America to go take jobs everywhere around the world and not pay a penalty for it. And this is where I'm a tariff person. And I know right now there's this knee-jerk reaction from my friends on the left. Tariffs are bad, raises prices. Yeah, it does a little bit, but it also creates opportunities at home, and it raises wages. And again, wages, if it's keeping up with inflation, not a problem. The problem is when inflation outpaces wages, and what helps that? A strong labor movement. So it seems to me that we could be doing things a lot smarter policy-wise, which again is why I am a union person and not willing to allow the benevolence of a corporation to just, you know, gift me whatever it is they think I'm worth. Because here's the thing, it hasn't worked very well, has it? You know, I had a conversation with someone, you know, the other day who said, I'm a capitalist. I'm going, I don't know what that means. You know, tell me what kind of capitalist. Because if you're a capitalist, you can't be angry at the inflation. Because, well, I would argue inflation hasn't been bad enough in a free market for people to stop buying the products. We keep buying this stuff. You know, I asked a woman in the grocery store who was complaining about the price of milk. I go, well, why do you buy it? Well, she didn't have an answer. I go, if it's too expensive, don't buy it. Buy something else. She was, you know, talking about all this stuff. It's all too expensive. Then don't buy it. Buy something cheaper. That's the wonder of the free market. It's what we're told in, you know, in Econ 101. The natural level of prices is, you know, the invisible kind of natural price point is the point at which people will stop buying it. We haven't hit that. So all this complaint about inflation, you're still buying it. You know, I had someone complain to me, you know, I went out to dinner and it was $90. I go, well, you know, how do you fix that? Oh, I go, cook at home. Well, whoa. And you go, well, whoa, that's how you solve this. But I digress. I'm just happy that we have an industrial policy and we are moving in the right direction. Also, I want a real quick update. You know, things are going well at home. My wife is stable. Things are progressing. Again, for folks who want to send her communications, letters, cards, best wishes, you can do that at therickSmithShow.com. You can do that by sending us a letter at P.O. Box 1026, Carlisle, Pennsylvania, 170113. You can send that to Carol Smith at P.O. Box 1026, Carlisle, PA, 170013. I'm greatly appreciative for all the folks who have, obviously, taken time to send their wishes. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.